Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking about, I think, one of the major problems for health in the foreseeable future, and that is the rise of antibiotic-resistant bacteria and all the things associated with that. One reads a lot about the drug-resistant tuberculosis up in New York and around the world, but it's not just tuberculosis. There's a whole range of diseases caused by bacteria that we don't quite know how to treat. And sure, we can keep making new molecules. I do a lot of tin chemistry, and they kill everything. But they kill the bacteria, they kill the host. It's not very good. And so there's a new concept, new to Keith Pannell, antisense antibiotics. And so to talk about that today and have a conversation with us is Professor Bruce Geller. He's at Oregon State University, and he's a professor of microbiology. And I got a special co-host this week. That is Professor Stephen Ailey, who is also trained as a microbiologist at the University of Texas at El Paso. So, gentlemen, welcome, and let's do a program.
Okay, Keith.
Well, thank you, Keith.
Okay, so Bruce, we'll start with you, and we always like on this program to get a feel for the guest. How did you get into being a scientist? What were those early experiences that made you say to yourself, my gosh, this is good stuff. I like it. And I think when I grow up, I want to do something like this. So what's your story?
Well, you know, I think it comes down to curiosity. I think I've always been a curious person, also kind of a critical thinker, you know, and when I didn't understand something, it always kind of challenged me, and I always wanted to know more and try and understand things around me. You know, I've been really doing science since middle school, or what they used to call it, junior high school, back when I was in school. But, you know, my dad worked for a pharmaceutical company, and even though he wasn't a scientist, he was on the business side of things, I had access to some very, very high-level scientists at the pharmaceutical company, and they would help me with science projects in middle school and high school. And I was doing very, very sophisticated types of experiments well beyond my years at an early age. And I think all that just kind of carried over and stayed with me my entire life.
So you were doing some of this work actually in the pharmaceutical company laboratories?
Well, actually, I did a lot of experiments at home. It seems incredible, but back in those days, there wasn't as much oversight. So I even had things like research animals, rats and mice, in my basement at the house. I also did projects. I remember one project where I tried to recreate the conditions that were thought to have been prevalent during the formation of the Earth.
And, you mean prebiotic chemistry in the basement?
Yes, and I had this really toxic brew in a sparker from a Model T car container in the basement of my dad's shop, and we actually had a bottle of bromine. And bromine is an extremely toxic material. But back in those days, you could do things like this, and I had bromine, and it actually, some of it escaped from the container, and it oxidized my dad's tools, and all of his tools in his shop had this brown rust coating over it. But anyway, luckily, nobody was hurt, and I didn't recreate life.
Did you at least have a smoke detector in the house?
Not back then, no.
Well, what a wonderful father. Everybody should have a father like that, right? You know, just let the son get down there and do things. And in fact, I was reading, I think yesterday, the Wall Street Journal, or the day before, a little article saying about some people who are trying to create the Big Bang in the laboratory, right? And they thought the Hadron Collider could do that also. So anyway, you got a quick start to your career, right?
Yeah.
Where did you go to school? Where did you study formally as opposed to informally in the basement?
Well, in my first year at the university, I studied downhill ski racing. I was on the ski team, so fortunately, maybe for me, I didn't really do so well that year. But after that, I focused on chemistry, and I got a degree in chemistry from Michigan State University. That was my bachelor's degree. And along the way, I was doing research as a research helper, a research assistant with a number of university professors that synthesized new compounds for testing against various diseases such as malaria.
Okay, so downhill skiing, and then after that it was all uphill, right? That's great. I like that. But you hit on the point straight away that you worked as an undergraduate doing research, and that's always something which I think stimulates kids in school and university. But not only that, you were working for people who are sort of indeed trying to make bioactive molecules, and that is the game. I mean, it's a hit and miss. There's so many ideas that you say, well, I've got an idea, you go out and do it. It takes you 3 years to make it and characterize it and 1 year to practice with it. And then it turns out to be no good. So we've got to find an alternative methodology of finding antibiotics, I think, right?
Well, I guess that's sort of the idea behind what we're doing now. You know, the way in which antibiotics are developed, or at least the way in which they've been developed traditionally, is for scientists just to go out and take environmental samples such as soil and water, bring them back to the lab and see if there's anything in those samples that can kill a bacterium in a petri dish. And once they found something that kills bacteria in a petri dish, there's a long developmental process where they have to make sure that the compound that they found that's in this mixture from soil or water doesn't also, for instance, kill the host, the human. And that's been a really good strategy through the 1950s and 1960s, but it just has died out. It's been unproductive in the last 30 years, and we really need a different strategy of first discovering new antibiotics and then developing them.
And that's where you've come in with this antisense antibiotic. So before we go any further, just to clarify for me and the audience, antisense, what does this mean?
Well, okay, so listeners will recall that DNA is made of two strands, two oligomers. One strand is called the sense strand, and one's called the antisense strand. And they run in anti-parallel directions, and that's where the term comes from. Our synthetic antibiotic is actually a mimic of a little snippet of DNA on the antisense strand of a gene. And this little snippet of a DNA mimic gets into the bacterium, and we purposely target it to a specific gene, and it actually binds to, well, not the gene, but the messenger RNA that's made by the gene. It binds to it, and it stops the synthesis of the protein that's encoded by the gene.
So it's competitive for a particular site.
If I can jump in just for a second. The sense strand is the part of the RNA that actually is used to make a protein, so it makes the key parts of the cell. The antisense strand actually can bind to that sense strand and stop it from making the protein, and that's why we're so interested in that. It's more than just competitive, it's complementary, and it targets specifically a particular gene.
And how does it get in there again?
How does it get in? I mean, like into the bacterium cell,
yes,
right?
Right.
Well, you know, actually, that was a key development. When I first started testing these little antisense molecules that we call PPMOs, it's an acronym for a chemical name, what we found was that they weren't getting into the bacterium. And so I went to the literature, and I saw that other scientists around the world had been challenged with the same issue, and they were linking membrane-penetrating peptides, short little polypeptides, to the ends of macromolecules, things that were too big to get into bacteria. And these little membrane-penetrating bacteria would kind of drill through the membrane of bacteria and would drag their cargo with them, these large macromolecules. So I decided I'd use the same strategy, so we attached membrane-penetrating peptides, a couple of them, different types of membrane-penetrating peptides, to our PMO, and that created the PPMO, which is peptide-conjugated PMO, and it worked like a charm. The efficacy was improved over tenfold, probably a hundredfold, so that's how we get them into the bacterium now. We use these membrane-penetrating peptides that the chemist actually conjugate, make covalent bonds to the antisense molecule.
That's amazing.
Can you, in fact, then tell the listener? I mean, is this a general sort of feature? If I want to put a little bit of some molecule that I'm playing with and add one of these penetrating peptides to the molecule, it will take anything in? Or does there have to be some compatibility between the penetrating peptide and the molecule that you're trying to drag in with it?
Well, yeah, I would say in general, yes, but, you know, you'd have to really try it to know for sure. I suppose there might be some incompatible substances that couldn't be dragged in, but, you know, they're using these membrane-penetrating peptides to bring in proteins, for instance, and, you know, I would say that, you know, you just have to try and see, but in general, I'd say, yeah, you could bring in a lot of different types of substances.
So do these peptides work on all different kinds of bacteria equally well, or are there some that work better than others?
Yeah, that's interesting. We've done a lot of structure activity studies where we've varied the amino acids that compose the membrane-penetrating peptides to see what is the functionality of these membrane-penetrating peptides. Could we improve on them? Do all bacteria require the same membrane-penetrating peptides? And the answer is that generally we find that two of our membrane-penetrating peptides work very well on just about everything we've tried, except for Burkholderia. Burkholderia is a gram-negative bacterium that often infects immunocompromised people. It causes pneumonia in cystic fibrosis patients, for instance, or pneumonia in patients with chronic granulomatous disease. In that particular case, with Burkholderia, we need a different membrane-penetrating peptide than the ones that work well against, for instance, E. coli, Acinetobacter baumannii, Pseudomonas aeruginosa, or Klebsiella pneumoniae.
Can you say all those quickly for us there, Keith?
No, I think I'll just leave it alone. But the interesting point to me, though, is that, well, I don't know quite the answer to the question. What's the relative size of the membrane-penetrating peptide and the rest of the molecule that you're dragging in to do the actual work, the antisense portion?
So there are about 10 to 12 amino acids in length for the peptide, and the oligomer, the antisense molecule, is 11 bases in length. The molecular weight of the sum of the two is around 6,000. So 6,000 is way too big to get into gram-negative bacteria. Gram-negative bacteria allow solutes or dissolved substances in the medium to enter the cell by diffusion only when they have a molecular weight of about 600 or less. So we're way above the threshold for entering these gram-negative bacteria by simple diffusion. And the way in which these molecules, our molecules, actually enter the cell is by going around the diffusion channels and just drilling through, if you will, the lipids of the outer membrane. And once the membrane-penetrating peptide drills into the lipids, it will drag with it the antisense molecule.
And when it's gone through, does it sort of repair automatically behind it? Or does it leave a bloody great big hole in the membrane?
No, it seems to repair itself, and it requires that the antisense molecule actually has its effect on inhibiting the expression of the specific gene to which it's targeted. And we know that because if we, and we do this routinely, we use control PPMOs where we have a sequence, a base sequence of our oligomer that's targeted to no gene at all, okay? And we call that a scrambled PPMO. When we do that, it gets into the cell, okay, but there's no target on which it can act, and the bacteria live. So apparently they repair the hole that's been drilled through the membrane.
Okay, very interesting. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here in the studio with Professor Steve Ailey, and we're talking to another professor, Bruce Geller, over at Oregon State University in the Department of Microbiology, that's sort of really making waves with a whole new way of talking about antibiotics. And we'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Stephen Ailey, Bruce Geller from Oregon State University, and we're talking about antisense antibiotics. And it's been fascinating so far. And so we've got these little membrane-penetrating peptides that can somehow bind to things, well, easily we can bind them to things, and then drag them through membranes, deposit at the other end. Now, when you want the sequence that you've added, the antisense portion, to graft on, if you like, to the mechanisms inside the bacteria, how does the penetrating protein get lost, so to speak? Or does that stick around also?
That's actually something we don't know the answer to.
That's why I asked the question. I suspected as much.
Yeah, it's not clear whether it gets cleaved off or whether it's retained within the cytoplasm. And it's not clear, theoretically, whether you'd want to retain it or not. It's possible that if the membrane-penetrating peptide were not cleaved off, once it reached the interior of the cell, it might just burrow its way back out. So a little
transporter.
Yeah. And so we kind of favor the notion that it's cleaved off, but we don't have any real hard evidence for that. We've tried attaching the peptide to the opposite end of the antisense molecule to see if that made a difference. And we find that it makes rather little difference when we're targeting messenger RNA. It does, however, sometimes make a difference when we're targeting things other than messenger RNA.
Okay, so you've got your little span of nucleic acid materials in the cell. Now, what's it going to do when it's in there? How does it get into the sequence that's important for you for the antibiotic behavior?
Okay, so we have the chemist synthesize these antisense molecules with a specific sequence of nucleic acid bases. They're the same four bases that are used in DNA. And these bases then bind with a complementary base on their target. And we choose the target that's a known gene. And initially, we were targeting essential genes. So that when our antisense molecule binds to the messenger RNA of an essential gene, that inhibits the expression of that essential gene. And that causes the cell to die. And so, with all the wealth of the genomes that have been sequenced now, and there's something like 10,000 bacterial genomes that have been completely sequenced that are readily available in the public databases. So anyone who has the knowledge to do so can for free go to these databases and get the sequence of the genes of any bacterium that's been sequenced and all of the important pathogens have been completely sequenced now. So we go into those databases, and using the literature, we select specific genes that are known to be essential for viability of these pathogens. And then we go back and have the chemist synthesize an antisense molecule that's exactly complementary to that one specific gene. And we can target any number of genes.
So that's actually a fascinating topic because that lets you get a very specific antibiotic. Most of the antibiotics we use, like penicillin or tetracycline, hit way too many bacteria. It hits bacteria we'd like to keep. But you can now target specifically the bad bacteria and not touch the good ones.
You know, Steve, you've really hit on one of the major advantages of our technology. It's gene-specific, and because each of the genes is different in every bacterium, our molecule only works on one specific bacterium. And the advantage to that is that we can go in and we can kill a pathogen in a host, like a human, and not disrupt all the good bacteria that live in the host. Anyone who's taken an antibiotic knows there are side effects, and sometimes they're fairly severe. For instance, diarrhea is a common side effect. If you've taken an oral antibiotic, all that antibiotic is going down into your gastrointestinal tract, down into your gut, and it's killing the good bacteria along with the bad bacteria. Our antisense approach only kills the bad bacteria.
Well, you just said our approach. Are there other laboratories doing the same thing? And given the wonderful goal here and the potential for making a lot of money, I must say, must be a lot of companies trying to get into this act also. So there must be this isn't just your laboratory anymore, I suspect, or maybe I'm wrong.
No, I certainly don't work on an island by myself. In fact, my major collaborator is one of Steve's colleagues at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center, Dr. David Greenberg. He's an associate professor there in Dallas. And together, we have worked on this project for many years, but we don't work alone either. It's also a partnership with industry as well as with federal government. We work very closely with a company called Sarepta Therapeutics. It's their chemists that actually synthesize all the compounds that we use, and they hold many of the patents for the methods of chemical synthesis of these antisense molecules. And then the third leg of this project is the support from the National Institutes of Health that we receive.
So, Bruce, one of the big features of your approach is that you can quickly target new proteins and such. Do you have a problem with resistance to your molecules?
I wouldn't say we have a problem. I would say that we've looked at resistance, and we have published a paper on the frequency of resistance, and it seems to be fairly similar to traditional antibiotics. However, the resistance is linked to the peptide, that membrane-penetrating peptide portion of the molecule, not to the antisense portion. And we were expecting to see, when resistance developed spontaneously, a change in the sequence of the target gene. We thought that the way that bacteria would become resistant would be to change one of the bases of the gene that we're targeting. That would then cause the antisense molecule not to bind as tightly to the target, and therefore making the antisense molecule less effective. However, we've never seen that, but what we have seen is resistance to the peptide portion. Now, we can get around that problem by putting on a different peptide.
Now I'm going back to medieval war. I'm thinking of the castle and the keep and the wall.
Yep.
So you're telling me that then somehow the membrane of the particular cell is being modified by the bacterium in order to stop your little protein being capable of crossing the membrane. Is that what you were saying here?
Well, it turns out that the mechanism of resistance that we found was to a part of the membrane called an active transporter. It's not the lipid portion, it's the protein that's in the plasma membrane. And in the bacteria that we, so this gets a little bit more complex. The bacteria that we target, we have to focus on the bacteria, are called gram-negatives. Gram-negatives have two membranes. You can think of gram-negative bacteria as a sac within a sac. The outer membrane is the barrier to entry, and that's where the membrane-penetrating peptide comes in that we've already talked about. Once it's past that outer membrane, it still has to get through a second membrane. It's called the plasma membrane, in order to enter the interior of the cell where it can go to work on the genes. We found that there is a mutation in an active transport protein that brings the PPMO across the plasma membrane into the interior of the cell. And since the mutation was specific for the peptide, we can get around that problem by simply changing the peptide. If you put a different peptide on there, the bacteria are no longer resistant to the PPMO.
That goes back to the whole business of drug-resistant materials. These bacteria seem to change in miraculous ways, for someone who's a chemist, in order to protect themselves and to prolong their capacity to reproduce. I mean, is it any different? You've got to keep changing then the membrane-penetrating protein in order to overcome the resistance that these bacteria are inculcating. Is it not just the same? We're back to the same square? You know, we've got to keep on modifying the medication, if you like.
Yeah, you know, I appreciate that. And so I'll say a couple things. First of all, I think that any one substance, any one antibiotic, the bacteria are going to develop resistance to it sooner or later. their ancestors have been around, and the bacteria have been developing for 4 billion years on Earth. This is what you're getting at. They're very good at getting around anything that's thrown at them. After all, antibiotics come from nature, right? So they've been developed for billions of years in the presence of antibiotics. They know how to get around any one substance. So my thought is that we're going to have a combination of two, maybe three different PPMOs in a cocktail approach, so that numerically the probability of developing resistance to both substances simultaneously would be very improbable, in fact, impossible.
So, Bruce, you've been talking about one kind of bacteria, the gram-negative. How does your system work against the other kinds of bacteria?
So we haven't looked at gram-positives as much, and then that was mostly just a strategic decision, or maybe tactical decision. There were a number of new antibiotics that were being developed for MRSA and other gram-positives about 10 years ago. And from a commercial standpoint, Sarepta Therapeutics looked at this and said, you know, let's not go up against these other guys and try to compete with some of these newer antibiotics that's come along. Let's focus on gram-negatives, because there hasn't been the pipeline for gram-negative antibiotics have dried up. We haven't had a new antibiotic that's effective against gram-negative bacteria in over 30 years. That's how bad it is. So it was just sort of a tactical decision, commercial decision. But on a biological level, they do work against gram-positives. And in fact, we published one paper where we were able to kill the causative agent of anthrax, Bacillus anthracis. That's a gram-positive, and as you know, that's been used as a bioterrorist weapon. It killed a number of people in attacks, and we showed and published in the literature that our antisense molecules work well against it.
Well, that's pretty impressive. We've just got about half a minute left. Give me a sort of prognostication. Will we be seeing this type of antisense antibiotic down at your local friendly Walgreens or CVS or whatever in 5 years, 10 years?
I'd say hopefully 5 years. Hopefully it won't take 10 years. But we still have a number of developmental steps that must be met, and I think that will take probably about 3 years to complete if we can get funding. And then there'd be the whole process of testing it in humans, first for safety and then for efficacy. And that would take at least another 2 years. So realistically, 5 years at a minimum.
Okay. And of course, the current sort of political scene is to sort of cut through some of the regulations that have been sort of hampering, if I can use that expression without meaning it, development of drugs. There are a lot of people think the FDA, for example, takes far too long. And so there may be some shortening, and with risk, I suppose. But I just wanted to throw that out there before the program finishes.
Yeah. Well, no, Congress has passed a couple of different laws, and I think they were enacted by the president, signed off on, and that speed up the process and also give some additional intellectual property protection to those that are developing these antibiotics. So there are things in place for speeding up the process and financial incentives. We're hopeful that we can continue to develop these things.
Jolly good. Bruce Geller, professor of microbiology at Oregon State University. It's been a fascinating program. I've learned a lot. Therefore, I think the audience will have learned a lot. And Steve Ailey here at the University of Texas, El Paso, thank you for coming in. And
thank you for having me.
Being a co-host.
No, thank you very much, Keith.
And thank you, Kimberly Garcia, for putting the program together. It'll sound wonderful when it's aired, and that's all because of her. And we'll be back next week with another program. And who knows what it'll be, so you have to be there to listen. Bye-bye.